Havana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about pregnancy and alcohol. I think probably a lot of people listening will be familiar with the term fetal alcohol syndrome. Women who drink frequently, and that is generally defined as 4 or 5 alcoholic beverages or more every day, increase greatly the chances that their babies will have fetal alcohol syndrome. It's considered to be one of the leading causes of birth defects and is thought to be the most common cause of preventable mental retardation in the United States. Pregnant women today are regularly warned that alcohol can have harmful effects on their babies, and they are told to avoid it. What's interesting, if you look at the history of fetal alcohol syndrome, you see, first of all, that it's a term that has not been with us forever, certainly not for a very long time. It was coined in the early 1970s. And if you look back before then, you find that for a long time, alcohol was generally considered harmless during pregnancy. In fact, it was even given to women to stop premature labor. In this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about how this change came about and what it tells us about our attitudes towards women and pregnancy. And our guest for the program is Janet Golden. She is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, and she is a specialist in medical history, women's history, and children's history, and is the author of a book that looks at the making of fetal alcohol syndrome. Her book is titled Message in a Bottle, and it is published by the Harvard University Press. It's out there, available in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. And of course, here this morning on our program on Focus 580, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. And anyone listening can be involved in the conversation. The only thing we ask of people is that people just are brief and try to keep their comments short, just so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving. Of course, anybody's welcome to join in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or in fact, if you might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, and the local number, 333-9455. Professor Golden, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
I think that I read that one of the things that started you thinking about this was when you noticed that there was a warning label on liquor bottles, and mm-hmm. you started thinking, well, that's interesting. Why is it that of all of the things we know about the potential hazards of overconsumption of alcohol, why is that the thing that's on there? Why is it warning pregnant women about drinking and not, you know, other kinds of warnings that one might imagine?
That's exactly right. I think it's so interesting that the first message on that bottle says women should not be drinking during pregnancy, and the second one is about operating a car and other machinery. And of course, we have many more accidents and fatalities related to drinking and driving than we do problems with fetal alcohol syndrome, although fetal alcohol syndrome is the most serious preventable birth defect. So I began to wonder, how is it that we've shaped the message that way and why? Mm-hmm. And that's what got me started on this book.
Well, and I think I do want to underscore the point that you make and what I mentioned at the beginning, that certainly no one would question that it's harmful to babies if their moms consume large amounts of alcohol. And it's pretty clear that it is harmful, and there's an identifiable list of effects, and that it's pretty clear that such a thing, that fetal alcohol syndrome does indeed exist.
Absolutely, and it's a worldwide phenomenon. Extremely heavy drinking that raises the mother's blood alcohol level to a very high level, often through binge drinking, results in damage to a fetus. And this is seen in studies around the world, and it is a problem around the world in places where people are abusing alcohol.
Yeah. Something also that's I don't know if this is getting too far into the story too much at the beginning, but it seems that certainly that message has been put out there in the media, certainly here in the United States, and a lot of couples have heard that, and a lot of women have taken that seriously and have decided that if they do routinely use alcohol in their life, they have decided that during the time of their pregnancy, they would not drink any alcohol at all. It would be a zero tolerance kind of a thing. That sort of leads to this question of, well, we recognize that heavy alcohol use is a problem, but apparently there's less sort of a consensus about using alcohol in smaller amounts. The recommendation is no alcohol at all, but apparently no one really knows where the line is that you cross between profound effects and lesser or no effects.
Absolutely right. One of the questions that we can't answer is how much is too much, in part because every single fetus is an individual fetus. And so different levels of exposure on different fetuses would have different effects. In some countries, they recommend no more than one drink a day. I believe the British used to say 2 units a day. Now they say none. There's not much consensus about the effects of what we would call light drinking. The consensus is that heavy drinking is where the problem is. And because we can't be sure, there might be one fetus that's exquisitely sensitive to alcohol, it's best to just say no. And many, many people have made the decision to just say no for the 9 months of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. What's one of the things that's really interesting is if you take a look at what people thought, even what physicians thought about alcohol consumption and pregnancy, if you go back before this point that we're talking about here in the early 70s when fetal alcohol syndrome is identified and named, and you see that there seems to be much less concern about alcohol use. And in fact, what's really fascinating is that it actually was thought to have therapeutic uses. It was actually given to pregnant women to help them relax.
That's right. It's funny to go back and read it now in light of what we now think. Of course, physicians had looked around their families, other families, millions of patients had consumed alcohol in moderation, and they'd seen no effects. And there's a lot of epidemiological findings and observations that said, oh, a little drinking is fine, to the point where some people said, gee, pregnant women have trouble sleeping, have a drink, or relax, have a drink. Then it was thought that alcohol, there were some wonderful experiments done to see if you could give women alcohol for anesthesia during childbirth, and they discovered that it slowed down the labor. So they said, aha, maybe we can use alcohol when women go into premature labor and prevent premature births, which are a serious health risk. So they tried doing that for a time. It was later discovered it was not particularly effective. The only thing that people really worried a lot about with alcohol before the 1970s were the calories, because mm-hmm. there was a big concern that women shouldn't gain too much weight when they were pregnant. So they always worried about the calories in the drink, but not the alcohol.
Yeah, they said empty calories. Watch out for empty calories. But
right.
But the other effects, that didn't seem to be that much concern. And, of course, also, as you point out, historically, if you look at people voicing concerns about alcohol and society, and the impact of heavy alcohol use, it seems that all of the attention was focused on men and abuse of alcohol by men and the problems associated with that. Not really quite so much looking at the problems associated with heavy use by women.
Absolutely right. We worried about the men who got their wages and went into the bar and drank up their wages, beat their wives, lost their jobs. Women's drinking was seen as kind of a quiet, private tragedy, or something that only prostitutes and other so-called bad women would be engaged in. And sometimes, actually, women's drinking was blamed on physicians. They said, oh, women were prescribed alcohol to recover from childbirth or to help them promote breastfeeding. And it was the doctors who prescribed the alcohol that got women started on drinking.
Let me just very quickly here introduce again our guest. We're talking with Janet Golden. She is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University and is particularly interested in medical history and women's history. Both of those things come together in her recent book, Message in a Bottle, The Making of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. It is published by the Harvard University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How did fetal alcohol syndrome come to be, even before that somebody put that name on it, the fact that it was there, that heavy alcohol use did result in a number of observable effects, and then that gets us to the point where we say actually that there is this thing that we call the syndrome. What was it that drew physicians' attention to the fact that there was a serious problem here?
Well, there are two stories I can tell you about that. One is there was a physician who worked in a prison in England, and he noticed that when his female prisoners who were alcoholics were imprisoned, they actually had healthier children than when they were out of prison and were able to drink. And so he wrote about the effects of that at the turn of the 20th century. Interestingly, he was so much against alcohol, he really focused most of his work on the effects of male drinking. Then there was a physician in France who observed the effects of alcohol by looking at children born to alcoholic families. And when he wrote up his research and tried to talk to people about it, he said people laughed at him. They just couldn't believe that. So it wasn't really until we had our study in Seattle that we really began to have the data that said, yes, this is a problem, and you know what, we can go back, we can look at some old medical records, and we can see, in fact, that abusive drinking, heavy chronic drinking by women during pregnancy has effects on the fetus.
Mm-hmm. Well, this raises obviously a really interesting question, because as you note in the book, that until the second half of the last century, nobody had seen it. It wasn't named until 1973, yet one has to believe that it was there, that it didn't just pop up suddenly. Why was it that it was not until after 1950 people started looking at it and saying, hey, we have a problem here, and then even after that, when it was named?
Well, there's several answers to that. One is, after Prohibition, Americans were very concerned about approaching the question of alcohol with a scientific perspective and to not overemphasize the bad effects of drinking. So they would tend to say things like, children who are raised by alcoholic mothers grow up in bad environments because the mothers aren't paying attention to them, the fathers are perhaps drinking as well very often. And so it's really an environmental problem. It's not that the alcohol is doing it. It's the alcoholic parents who were neglectful. So we had a kind of environmental explanation of the children's problems. Another reason was that some leading scientific researchers had before that said, well, alcohol creates bad germplasm. It affects the what we would now call the DNA, the heredity. So it's not that the alcohol has a direct effect on the fetal brain, but rather it's affected the sex chromosomes of the parents. So we had ready explanations, one rooted in environmentalism, one rooted in heredity, that kind of steered us away from seeing that alcohol is what we call a teratogen, something that affects the developing fetus.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it perhaps took some time, maybe now it would surprise us, but it took some time for medical researchers to realize that anything that the mom took in is going to end up affecting the baby. That is to say, the womb is not closed off from the outside world. That's sort of seemed surprising that it would take a long time for people to realize that baby and mom share a common blood supply. But in fact, I guess it did take a while for people really to appreciate just to what extent that was the case, and that something that mom took, whether it was alcohol, whether it was some kind of medication, whether, whatever it was, would indeed affect the fetus too.
Right. We had a big wake-up call about that a bit, what I call mass public education in the 1960s, first with the thalidomide tragedy. Thalidomide was thought to be a very safe sleeping pill, and it turned out that women who took thalidomide during the between the 8th and 11th week of pregnancy gave birth to children with missing limbs. So that was our first wake-up call. No, the womb is not a protective barrier. Shortly after that, we had a large epidemic of rubella, with large numbers of children who were born after being exposed in utero and had blindness, deafness, mental retardation. And so the rubella virus itself was also shown to damage the fetus. So that kind of awakened Americans, as did atomic energy testing, the effects of radiation, X-rays, things like that. We began to learn that, no, pregnancy was not a time of the fetus being protected, but a time of exposure, and we have to think about those exposures. And then, of course, the mass awareness that cigarette smoking, which is probably the most common exposure to fetuses, that too has serious effects.
Mm-hmm. There, fetal alcohol syndrome is not like some other things that you can do a blood test for. It's a kind of thing that is diagnosed in a sense based on a number of characteristics. Does the child have these characteristics? And of course, then if you can collect the history from the mother, then you can in a sense diagnose backwards from that or forwards from that. Is it really so clear? Cut a thing, or whether a child does or does not have it, or is it somewhat subjective?
Well, let me point out, number one, that, of course, fetal alcohol syndrome is a lifelong condition. So it is sometimes retrospectively diagnosed in adults, not just in children. Mm-hmm. Scientists are now working on ways to have a more definitive diagnosis, because oftentimes the children are not living with the birth mothers, or the adults are not living with their birth mothers. And so they're beginning to work on doing brain scans, things like that, that might show how, by looking at the brains of people who've been alcohol exposed and then looking at the brains of people with that suspected characteristic, if there are certain markers in the brain that will show that definitively it's got a particular kind of damage. And that's sort of one of the frontiers of science that they're moving to now through the National Institutes of Health.
Mm-hmm. I guess that then maybe the next thing to talk about is, once we got to the point, once where physicians, medical researchers got to the point where it was, where fetal alcohol syndrome was identified and named, so we knew that we had a problem, then the question is, okay, what do we do about it? And it seemed that we didn't really, at least initially, didn't have a lot of great options. I almost hesitate to bring up the subject of abortion, because I'm afraid we might then end up having a conversation about abortion. But the fact is that if you look at this period, you write that the identification of fetal alcohol syndrome came very shortly after Roe v. Wade. And so apparently one of the things that women, alcoholic women, were counseled by doctors if they were pregnant was simply to terminate the pregnancy.
That's right. One of the things that was immediately discussed was, let's recommend to severe chronic alcoholic women who are pregnant that they consider terminating the pregnancy, because the risk is so high, particularly for those who previously given birth to alcohol-affected children. Probably the greatest public effort beyond these private physician conversations was public education. And there was funding of public service announcements. There were some television advertisements in women's magazines, public service advertisements. And then after much resistance and political debate, the labeling of alcoholic beverages. One road the United States did not go down, that some of the other countries did, was to try and really look for alcoholic women of childbearing age and get them into treatment services, to say the problem isn't, the problem is that women are killing themselves by their abuse of alcohol, and they're also going to be affecting their fetuses, so let's make sure we do the outreach and we get them into alcoholism treatment. And we understand that alcoholism is a chronic and relapsing condition, so we continue to make treatment available. That was done in Scandinavia and some other countries quite successfully, but as you know, in the United States, we don't have a kind of national health system that could do that, and we don't have a mental health parity in our health insurance program. So oftentimes it's very hard for people, even with insurance, to access that kind of services.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, it's sadly enough, it reflects the kind of approach that we've taken to dealing with substance abuse, and that is looking at it largely as a law enforcement problem and as a defective person problem, not so much as a public health problem, and have put very little in the way of resources into trying to help people who have substance abuse, whether it's alcohol or some other kind of drug.
That's right. The policies adopted in Europe that we call generically harm reduction, let's stop the harm, let's stop the transmission of problems, let's stop people from hurting themselves, is not a path that the United States was eager to go down. And that's still a topic that's debated today in HIV care. Should we distribute clean needles or shouldn't we? Well, that's a harm reduction policy. It's used pretty widely in the developed world. But in the United States, it's kind of an issue that's left up to the localities. The same thing is true of substance abuse. Should we make sure that people who are abusing substances have access to inpatient detoxification and support services, methadone, alcoholism treatment, whatever, or do we want them to kind of see the light and quit on their own and become better people for it? So we've really made a political choice there, and as a result, we do have some serious substance abuse problems.
It's also interesting here that we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that historically, as people have thought about and looked at the problem of alcohol abuse, it was for a long, long time looked at as a men's problem. And that one of the things that kind of goes hand in hand here with the identification of the problem, the hazards of pregnancy and alcohol, is that it shines a light on female alcoholism. Which was something that probably before that hadn't gotten very much attention. Did the rise of fetal alcohol syndrome somehow change the way that we thought about women and drinking, sort of pregnancy aside?
Well, actually, the discovery of fetal alcohol syndrome, as we call it, that was labeled in 1973, came just at the peak of a feminist movement that was calling for more attention to women's problems of substance abuse. Statistics show that more men do abuse alcohol, but almost all the resources went in the direction of helping men, and even AA meetings were closed to women, and many of them, because they were thought to be a distraction. The feminist movement, the feminist healthcare movement, made demands on the federal government that funding be put into looking at problems of women's substance abuse, both drugs and alcohol, that there be state task forces looking at the problem. And then when fetal alcohol syndrome came along, it sort of added more impetus to that. And so today you'll find that if you see where our funding and research goes, there's quite a bit more attention now to women's abuse of various substances than there had been in the past. But I'd really credit the feminist movement with that and fetal alcohol syndrome for giving it an extra push.
Over time, since fetal alcohol syndrome was named in 1973, and there has been a greater kind of public education effort, as you have described, there's certainly discussion in the media. The message is out there that says consuming alcohol, particularly a lot of alcohol in pregnancy, is potentially harmful, and the recommendation is that you not have any at all. And we've talked about the fact that there's a warning on alcohol packages. Given all that, what has happened with the numbers of children who are born with fetal alcohol syndrome, and indeed have we reduced those numbers?
Well, I'm sorry to say that we haven't done a very good job in reducing the numbers. We've done a very good job of educating people, and there are many people who are, many women who were, I would call them light drinkers, who said, you know what, I'll abstain. But reaching the hardcore, severe, chronic alcoholic women has not been very successful. And so the rate of fetal alcohol syndrome, particularly in certain communities, remains quite high, in part because poor women have trouble accessing prenatal care, They have trouble getting detoxification and support services. A lot of detox centers actually won't admit pregnant women because they're concerned about fetal outcome being sued. There are not very many beds for women in those settings. Families sometimes cover it up. They need women to take care of children. They sort of don't send them off for a detox when they need it because, in fact, they say, oh, we can't have mom go away. We need her to do work around the house. So there are many, many problems that have prevented the sort of most at-risk tier of women from getting the support they need to stop drinking. And as a result, the rates have not declined where they should have. It is one of the goals of the Healthy People 2000, Healthy People 2010. It is a stated goal of our public health system. But it's not going to be achieved, I think, until we have a better system in place for helping people with substance abuse problems.
We're just a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of focus. We have a caller we'll get right to. I do, again, want to introduce our guest. We're talking with Janet Golden. She is Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, and she is a specialist in medical history and in women's and children's history. She has authored a book that looks at the making of fetal alcohol syndrome. The title of her book is Message in a Bottle, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, someone on a cell phone here near us, North Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a question. Have they started studies now on, I guess you would call them SSRI syndromes, with so many people on these medicines, are they finding that children are being affected because of the, obviously, the neurotransmitter issues involved? And how about studies on maybe the old diazepams? Have they been looking at that? Are they beginning to look at it? Do we have to wait another 10 years before they'll it'll show up? I'm curious about that because it seems to me that that's sort of a new drug. Abuse, not abuse by them as much as by the doctors giving them. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Is that something you can talk about, Professor?
Oh, it's an excellent question, but I don't know the answer. And I'm going to suggest a place to look for that answer. And that is if you go to the National Institutes of Health website, www.nih.gov, where are all of that health research is going on. I think they will probably have a question, a search engine there where you could put that question in. It may be with the National Institute of Child Health and Development. It may be, in fact, at the CDC website may have that. So I believe the information would be out there in our latest known studies. But I'm not equipped to answer that, although I think it's a great question.
Hmm. And, you know, I guess that as we know that there are a lot of women who heard that message about the harmful effects of alcohol, as you said, the recommendation is not to drink any. And a lot of women have simply said, okay, then for the time of my pregnancy, I'm not going to have any alcohol. There are similar parallel concerns about anything else that you take in. And I think that probably also that there are a lot of women who would say, I tried hard not to take in anything. I didn't even want to take a Tylenol. I didn't want to, if I had a cold, I didn't want to take a Benadryl, which may be going a little bit too far. Is there some connection between wanting to try to eliminate any and all unusual substances, some connection between that and this knowledge that alcohol was a problem?
Well, you know, it's such an interesting question because, yes, when the first warnings came out about fetal alcohol syndrome, doctors were getting calls from women who said, I was at a party, I had some rum raisin ice cream, should I have an abortion? And, of course, the answer was no. Women are very worried and concerned about their pregnancies, and so physicians have gotten quite a bit more training now about answering these questions. In the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists puts out pamphlets that doctors give to patients. So there's quite a bit of information out there, quite a bit on the web from federal government sites about what's at risk, what's not. So I think that, yes, there are a lot of people, we might call them healthy and worried, and this is heightened awareness. At the same time, I think our biggest concern has to be with people who don't know they're pregnant, don't have access to prenatal care, and may not know the effects of the drugs that they're taking. It's very interesting, of course, now if you take almost any medication, there'll be a warning on there whether or not you do not take if pregnant or nursing or something like that. Often that simply reflects the fact that it hasn't been tested, so we don't know and we're erring on the safe side, but certainly can make you afraid to take almost anything or eat almost anything.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone, also someone here on cell phone, on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. You guys are actually talking about a very relevant topic. I had a friend of mine, and you just mentioned about the drugs and whether they're safe with pregnancy, who there's a new medication out, from what I understand, is Campral. And I apologize if you did talk about this earlier in the show, but it's called Campral, and it's supposedly the best new medication that's come out in the series, probably about 8 to 10 years. And it worked very well for her as far as during the relapse. The relapse was a lot less severe. Just reading up on the drug since then, I found that it's been very successful, just launched here in the last couple of months. So I'm wondering if you guys have heard a lot of success about this Campral and if treatment centers are starting to use this as part of their therapy.
Do you know about that, Dr.
No, I don't know a thing about that. Is that it for alcohol abuse?
Yes, for alcohol dependence.
Huh.
And it's new on the market. She was given this by her doctor and said, try this out, what have you. And she had problems over the years. And since then, like I said, I've been reading up on it. And it's very, very interesting. Some of the studies show that three times as many patients completely abstained from alcohol went on Campral. And these were patients who were historically relapsing into alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence. So it's something worth looking at when you're talking about fetal alcohol syndrome. Now, I don't know how safe it is in pregnancy. I'm assuming, like you said, it's just as safe as anything else, you know, where the benefits have to outweigh the risks. But it's definitely something that worked for her, and I don't know. I hope it helps many other patients.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful treatment, and I think it's important to note that the federal government has been conducting more and more experiments on brain development and alcohol, on the new drugs for alcoholism treatment, when we put our research scientists to work on very common public health problems, we can often get some good new treatments and some good new results, and it sounds like this is one of them.
Yeah, and it's hopefully another step in the right direction, no doubt. So.
And I applaud your friend for her efforts on her own behalf there.
Yeah, she's doing very well, so we'll keep praying for her.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Now, apparently, this is a medication that has not been generally available very long. According to what I see here, it was just approved by the FDA last July, so it's only been generally available for a little bit more than a year.
Mm. So we'll have some new studies coming out on that, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. Let's continue. We have some other callers here. We'll have someone up next in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Mike, I'm mentoring a teenager who I believe has fetal alcohol syndrome, and I'm wondering more about, you know, the symptoms, the damage done, and I know it's very individual from case to case, but just wondered if you could talk a bit more about that, what symptoms to look for and what how to help.
Uh-huh. Well, those are wonderful questions, and I'm not sure I can give you the answer, but I know because making that diagnosis is something that really has to be done by specialists. There's a lot of measurement of facial features as well as brain effects. The National Institutes of Health, I can send you to their website, or the Centers for Disease Control, www.cdc.gov. They have a Center for Birth Defects, and they have very effective information there about fetal alcohol syndrome, about working with people with fetal alcohol syndrome, about structures of interaction that give people sort of a feeling of security and ability to learn without distractions. So let me send you to the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institute on Birth Defects within that website, and they'll have a lot of useful information for you.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is also someone in Urbana, here where we are, line two. Hello.
Hello. I have two comments. First, I believe the drug, you might have mentioned it while I was dialing in, is called naltrexone, is the generic name. They've done lots of studies on it with alcoholism and also treating other types of drug addiction. So it's been very recently approved by the FDA for the treatment of alcoholism. My main comment, however, and I was wondering if your guest could speak to this, it seems that we get lots of attention in the media and in the helping professions when we find a child who's been drug exposed as an infant or as in utero to crack cocaine mostly. And yet when you look at the actual numbers, the numbers of kids that are affected by crack cocaine is infinitesimal compared to the number that are affected by alcohol and tobacco. And yet the outrage on a societal level is so far in the other direction. I wonder if your guest can comment on that and how we might improve advocacy on those issues. Thank you.
Well, that's a wonderful historical question, and I thank you for that question. I would certainly agree that the abuse and exposure to legal substances, alcohol and tobacco, is much, much, much greater than it is to children being exposed to other substances, and the effects are documented and much more devastating. But as long as we separate substances into the legal and the illegal, I think we're going to have this problem of paying attention to substances that are taken illegally and not to the outcome and the effects of that on fetuses and on individuals. I think everybody's well aware that smoking kills many more people in the United States than the taking of illegal drugs, and yet our media attention, of course, is on illegal drugs. I'm also aware, and I've been educated by a wonderful group called the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, that exposure to cocaine, and now there's some discussion of exposure to methamphetamine, there's been a lot of claims made about its effects on fetuses, and it's not been documented. And just yesterday, a group of physicians put out a letter in response to, I believe it was a Newsweek cover story where they used the term meth baby to say, you know, there's no medical evidence for this. It only serves to stigmatize women and children. It doesn't do anything about promoting the end to substance abuse and addiction. And this prominent group of physicians, I think led by a Dr. Brown at Brown University, is asking that we not use that term. So I think you've called attention to an important problem. I think that as long as we look at whether a substance is legal or illegal rather than the effects of that substance, we're going to miss the mark in terms of our public health needs and in terms of being able to help people.
Is the caller still there? Does that get at your question?
Yes, I am. That does answer my question, and I'm glad that you brought attention to the fact that the research really hasn't borne out the hysterical claims, I think, made in the mid-1980s about crack cocaine, that when we looked at these kids 10, 15 years down the road, we didn't see the type of severe damage that affects all areas of their lives, the way that we see with fetal alcohol syndrome.
That's right. Now, and many, I know that the New York Times had agreed to stop using the term crack baby, and then when this meth baby thing came out, there's just been a big uproar about it because there is no scientific support for the claim of damages. Now, certainly, taking cocaine, taking methamphetamine has terrible effects on those who take it, and being exposed in utero is not good by any means. But the lasting permanent brain damage, whether or not that has been found, there's no question that has not been found the way it has with alcohol or the way smoking has been shown to lead to lower birth weights, things like that. So we've kind of put our attention not on our core public health problems, but on some of our what we might call a criminal justice problem.
Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. Other people who are listening, if you would like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, you certainly may do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have the toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. Or if you happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And again, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Janet Golden. She is professor of history at Rutgers University and has written a lot about medical history and also women's and children's history. And that's her special areas of interest. And she's the author of a book that looks at the making of fetal alcohol syndrome. The title of her book is Message in a Bottle, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. We talked back at the beginning of the program about the fact that one of the things that got you interested in this subject was the warning label that's on the bottles for alcoholic beverages and the fact that it warns people about drinking and driving and it warns people about drinking and pregnancy. And interestingly enough, given that a lot more people are killed by drunk drivers, the first thing on there is about drinking and pregnancy. How did this warning label come about? And maybe you could talk a little bit about how the bottlers, the manufacturers, the people who made wine and beer and spirits felt about having that label on their bottles.
Well, when actually we're going to have to give credit to somebody named Strom Thurmond, a conservative Republican senator who very early on introduced legislation wanting warning labels on alcoholic beverages, long before fetal alcohol syndrome. After fetal alcohol syndrome, that idea had a new momentum. There were warning labels regarding pregnancy and warning labels on cigarette packages, and people said, well, why not on alcoholic beverages? The alcoholic beverage industry really geared up for a fight and was able to stop that legislation. It would be introduced, there would be Senate hearings, there would be hearings in the House, there would be some momentum, but they just were, it got enough senators and congressmen from states producing alcoholic beverages to say, no, we don't really need a label. Let's try public education. Let's try public service announcements. And then, very interestingly, there was a Supreme Court case about tobacco, known as the Cipollone case, in which it was said, gosh, there's a warning label on cigarette packages, so you can't go into state courts and sue for the effects of smoking. And then the alcoholic beverage manufacturer said, gee, if we had a federal warning label, we'd be protected from lawsuits, which were beginning to be filed in all the states regarding alcohol exposure, saying, oh, if only I'd known, I wouldn't have drunk when I was pregnant. So at that point, the alcoholic beverage manufacturers dropped their objections to a warning label, but they did make several stipulations, several deals with Congress. One is that our print advertisements and our beer advertisements on television do not carry those warnings. If you are old enough, you'll recall that cigarettes used to be advertised on television. They were pulled from TV. And if you read the magazines, you'll see that the cigarette advertisements carry warning labels, but the alcoholic beverage ones don't. Also, you'll note that there was some fight over the size of the print on that warning label. So now we have the words government warning and everything in all capital letters, and it's of a certain designated size, but it doesn't go on the front of the bottle. And that was a negotiation with the alcoholic beverage industry. There was an effort to have those beer commercials on TV include a warning. At that point, the beverage industry said, if you make us do that, we're going to stop all our advertising and you'll have no more sports on television. And so that idea was withdrawn.
One of the things that I know that you're interested in looking at the reaction to all of this was indeed how this colors or is colored by our attitudes towards particular people, towards poor people, towards minorities, towards women, towards people who fall into all of those categories. I mean, what are the sort of interesting things that we can learn or give us something to think about when that goes beyond this issue of exposure to the fetus and alcohol that has something broader to say beyond that?
Absolutely. Once we discovered that rates of fetal alcohol syndrome were much higher in Native American communities, something I think really well publicized by Michael Doris's book about his son, people began to say, oh, it's a problem of poor people. They're drinking too much. It's not about the alcohol. It's about the behavior of poor people. And so that kind of, I think, withdrew some public support for research and education and began to really stigmatize the women who drank rather than put the emphasis on let's get them information and help. It is true that in certain Native American communities, there are higher rates of alcohol abuse among women and than in the general population, and therefore there are higher rates of fetal alcohol syndrome. It also appears that people who binge drink have higher rates of birth defects in their children, the kind of fetal alcohol syndrome that results from binge drinking. And that would be because poor people very often will get paid once a month or get a support check once a month and will go out and drink very quickly, raise their blood alcohol level very high, and that will have effects, whereas people who are wealthier and alcoholic often stay drunk throughout the day, but perhaps their blood alcohol level doesn't get quite as high. So we've come to learn that there's different kinds of drinking. There's binge drinking, there's chronic drinking, and we really need to study that as well. One of the researchers I spoke to said, you know, we used to ask people, how much do you drink? And they'd say, oh, I only have two drinks a day. But then we learned to ask them to go over and pull off a glass off a shelf and pour in how much you drink a day. And some people were filling in 8-ounce tumblers with alcohol and say, see, I only have these two drinks a day. So, of course, the quantity is hard to measure by just asking how many drinks do you take.
One of the things that certainly we know is that people who have become sick from smoking have attempted to sue the tobacco companies. Has there been a similar sort of effort among people who had kids who had fetal alcohol syndrome trying to take legal action against the people who produced the alcohol?
There was a case. A set of cases that were filed in federal district court in Seattle. One of the cases came to trial, and the jury found in favor of the alcoholic beverage manufacturer. It turns out the alcoholic beverage industry has several, I would say, very good defenses going for it. One is that there's now a label. So from now on, people can say, the beverage manufacturers can say, we warned people. We're an industry that's regulated by the federal government, not by the FDA, but by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms under the Treasury Department because, of course, we tax alcoholic beverages. The second defense that I think the alcoholic beverage industry has going for it is women who give birth to children with demonstrable fetal alcohol syndrome are very often severe chronic alcoholics, and they've been told over and over again by their friends and their family that they need to stop drinking. They've been told by their physicians, if you continue to drink, you're going to kill yourself. Many of them have been in rehab several times and have relapsed. So as a plaintiff, it's very hard for them to make the claim, gee, I didn't know if I drank that it would have bad effects on my fetus, but they've been told over and over again, stop drinking or you're going to kill yourself. So they have, in effect, been warned. So those cases, the jury rejected them. They were taken out of court, and they have not proceeded very far. I believe there's some question now among the plaintiffs' bar as to whether or not claims can be brought in tribal courts and whether different laws apply there. But I'm not up to date on how those discussions are going.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that it is very clear that very large amounts of alcohol in pregnancy are problematic, and they can cause birth defects and retardation and some other things. And that it's clear to us that the large amounts do that. It is less clear that smaller amounts can have an effect as well. We talked about the fact that no one really knows where the line is that you cross between dramatic effects and lesser or no effects. And so overall, the recommendation is to women that you not drink any alcohol at all. We have not established that there is a safe level. So the recommendation is none. And certainly there are a lot of women, and when they discover that they're pregnant, they resolve not, if they are drinkers, they resolve not to drink during pregnancy. Is there any more research being done on that question of, is there a safe level, or have we made up our minds to the extent that we just say that there's no real good reason for doing research like that, and the best thing to tell women is best not to drink any at all?
I don't think we're ever going to have research where we deliberately expose women to any amounts of alcohol and then say, gee, does it have an effect? I don't think we could ever do that ethically because of its potential risk to a fetus. And I don't think anybody is going to sign a statement saying, sure, I'm willing to have two drinks a day to make sure it's safe, and to do this as an experiment. So I think that research has pretty much come to an end in terms of what we would call prospective research. I think that there is all around the world ongoing research where we do try and measure any effects of drinking from women who will talk about how much they drank during pregnancy. But again, you have to be very careful. When you ask somebody, how much did you drink, they've got to pour that drink themselves so you can see how many ounces it is. It also appears that when studies have been done, when you ask people immediately after pregnancy, how much did you drink, they say, oh, maybe one drink a week. If you ask them 5 years later, they might report, oh, I had a drink every day. So there's some recall issues there as well. But no, I don't think we'll be doing any studies where we distribute alcohol to pregnant women to see its effects. At least I cannot foresee that as an ethical medical experiment.
Well, we will have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled Message in a Bottle, The Making of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, by our guest, Janet Golden. She teaches history at Rutgers University. And Professor Golden, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for the show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. The broadcast today also made possible by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts and performance and presentation. Coming up later today on the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation about reducing crime and building community support for policing. The guest for the show will be David Harris. He's professor of law and values at University of Toledo. He's also an authority on racial profiling. He's the author of a new book on preventive policing titled Good Cops. And he'll be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. The show itself gets underway at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. There'll also be weather, sports, other sorts of things. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn. Coming up in the next part of this program, we'll be talking about this year's featured work, operatic work, as part of the Sugar Creek Festival in Watseka. It's Rossini's opera Cinderella. And we'll be talking with some folks from the festival, including one of the founders, the stage director of the production, and one of the performers. That's coming up in the next hour of Focus, so hope you will stay tuned. Right now, we'll break for news and update on the markets.
Well, weather is continuing to have an impact on prices on the Chicago Board of Trade, but as of right now, traders are still trying to figure out exactly what the forecasts are going to be. Prices have been tempered somewhat as they do that. There are some forecasts for rain, but just how much rain will fall in the Midwest and where it will fall remains the question. In the meantime, September wheat is down 1 at 325, December wheat at 339 and a half.